We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
Understanding what the surveillance state is, how it operates, and most importantly, figuring out how to challenge it really is, I think, an absolute prerequisite to any sort of meaningful activism.
Coming up, we'll hear a Chicago presentation by Glenn Greenwald, the journalist noted for his revelations of America's domestic surveillance systems.
So that principle of keeping it real emerged in the music because these were marginalized kids who were kind of critiquing society, saying that society is based on a lie.
And we'll hear from Chicago professor Lance Williams about corporatization of hip-hop music. On June 6, 2013, the Guardian newspaper of London broke the news that the cell phone company, Verizon, handed over to the government all the telephone data of 154 million of its customers. That was the first in a series of revelations regarding the surveillance of Americans by the National Security Agency and America's biggest cell phone and internet companies. The revelations have dominated the news in America and worldwide in the month of June and spurred badly needed discussion on civil liberties. The man who broke the news is a longtime activist on civil liberties and a journalist and blogger of The Guardian, Glenn Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald spoke in Chicago at the Socialism 2012 conference on June 28, 2012. We'll hear an excerpt from his presentation, providing background and context to the scandal of June 2013.
The surveillance state hovers over any attempts to meaningfully challenge state or corporate power. It doesn't just hover over it, it impedes it and deters it and chills it. That's its intent. It does that by design. And so understanding what the surveillance state is, how it operates, and most importantly, figuring out how to challenge it and undermine it and subvert it really is, I think, an absolute prerequisite to any sort of meaningful activism, to developing strategies and tactics for how to challenge state and corporate power. And so to begin this discussion, I want to just begin with a little story that I think is illustrative and significant in lots of ways. And the story is, it begins in the mid-1970s when there were scandals that were arising out of the Watergate investigation in the Nixon administration. And there were scandals surrounding the fact that, as it turned out, the Nixon administration and various law enforcement officials in the federal government were misusing their eavesdropping power. They were listening in on people who were political opponents. They were doing so purely out of political self-interest, having nothing to do with legal factors or the business of the nation. And this created a scandal. And unlike today, the scandal 40 years ago in the mid-1970s resulted in at least some relatively significant reactions. In particular, a committee was formed in the Congress, in the Senate. And it was headed by someone named Frank Church, who was a Democratic Party United States Senator from Idaho and had been in the Senate as of this time for 20 years or so, was one of the most widely regarded senators and was chosen because of that. And he led this investigation into these eavesdropping abuses and to try and get to the bottom of the scandal. And one of the things that he discovered was that these eavesdropping abuses were radically more pervasive and egregious than anything that had been known at the start of the investigation. It was by no means confined to the Nixon administration. In fact, it went all the way back to the 1920s when the government first began developing the technological capability to eavesdrop on American citizens, and heightened as the power heightened through the 1940s when the World War II justified it, into the 50s when the Cold War did, and then the 1960s when the social unrest justified surveillance. And what Senator Church found was that literally every single administration under both Democratic and Republican presidents had seriously abused this power, not in isolated ways, but systematically. And this committee documented all of the ways in which that was true, and the realization quickly emerged that allowing government officials to eavesdrop on other people, on citizens, without constraints or oversight, to do so in the dark, is a power that vests so much authority and leverage in those in power that it is virtually impossible for human beings to resist abusing that power. That's how potent of a power it is. But the second thing that he realized, beyond just the general realization that this power had been systematically abused, was that there was an agency that was at the heart of this abuse, and it was the National Security Agency. And what was really amazing about the National Security Agency was that it had been formed 25 years ago, back in 1949, by President Truman, and it was formed as part of the Defense Department, and it was so covert that literally for two decades, almost nobody in the government even knew that it existed, let alone knew what it did, including key senators like Frank Church. And part of his investigation, and it was actually fairly radical of an investigation, fairly aggressive, even looking at it through cynical eyes and realizing that the ultimate impact wasn't particularly grand, but the investigation itself was pretty impressive, and he forced his way into the National Security Agency and found out as much as he possibly could about it. And after the investigation concluded, he issued all sorts of warnings about the surveillance state and how it was emerging and the urgency of only allowing government officials to eavesdrop or surveil on citizens if they had all kinds of layers of oversight with courts and Congress. But he issued a specific warning about the National Security Agency that is really remarkable in terms of what he said. And this is what he said, and you can find this anywhere online, in the New York Times, everywhere. He said it as part of a written report and then in an interview. He said, quote, "The National Security Agency's capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter." He continued, "There would be no place to hide. If a dictator takes over the United States, the NSA could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back." Now, there's several things that I find extraordinary about that statement. For one, the language that he uses. I mean, this is not somebody who is a speaker at the Socialism 2012 conference saying these things. This was literally one of the people who was one of the most established institutional figures in American politics. I mean, he was in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but very much its mainstream. For many years, he chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and here he is warning the country about the dangers, not just of the U.S. government, but specifically about the national security state, and using words like dictator and total tyranny, and warning of the way in which this power could be abused such that essentially it would be irreversible, that once the government is able to monitor everything we do and everything we say, there's no way to fight back, because fighting back requires doing it away from their prying eyes. And if you look now, 30 years later, to where we are, not only would you never, ever hear a U.S. senator stand up and insinuate that the national security state poses this grave danger, or use words like tyranny and dictators to describe the United States the way that Frank Rich did only 30 years ago, now it's virtually a religious obligation to talk about the national security state and its close cousin, the surveillance state, with nothing short of veneration. Just a few weeks ago, Chris Hayes, who's an MSNBC host on the weekends, used the opportunity of Memorial Day to express the view in this very tortured, careful, and pre-apologetic way that maybe it's the case that not every single person who has ever served as an American soldier or enlisted in the American military is a hero. Maybe we can think about them in ways short of that. And this incredible controversy erupted. Condemnation poured down on him from Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals alike, and he was forced in multiple venues over the course of the next week to issue one increasingly sheepish apology after the next. That's how radically our discourse has changed, so that you cannot talk about the national security state or the surveillance state in these kind of nefarious terms the way that Frank Church, who probably knew more about it, did just a few decades ago. The second remarkable aspect of that story, of that quote to me, is that the outcome of that investigation was a series of laws that were grounded in the principle that, as I said earlier, we cannot allow government officials to eavesdrop on American citizens or in any way to engage in surveillance without all kinds of oversights and checks, the most illustrative of which was the FISA law that said that no government official can eavesdrop on our communications without first going to a court and proving to a court that we're actually doing something wrong and getting the court permission before they can eavesdrop. There was a similar controversy in the mid-2000s, in 2005, when the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration had been using the NSA to do exactly what Frank Church warned against, which is spying on the communications of American citizens. And the outcome of that was not new laws or new safeguards to constrain these sorts of abuses. It was exactly the opposite. In 2008, the Democratic-led Congress, with the support of President Obama and most of the supporters of his in the Democratic Party, as well as almost all Republicans, basically gutted that law, repealed it in its core, and made it much, much easier for the government to eavesdrop on American citizens without constraints, and then immunize the nation's telecoms that had participated in that illegal program. So you see the radically different attitudes that the United States has to surveillance just from 30 years ago, when abuses resulted in a whole variety of weak but still meaningful legal constraints versus what we do now when we find out that the government is lawlessly spying on us, which is act as quickly as possible to make it legal. But the third part of why I think Frank Church's statement is so remarkable is also the most important. If you look at what he said, he phrased his warning in a conditional sense. He said, if A happens, then B. A was if the NSA starts using its eavesdropping capabilities and not directing them at foreign nationals who we suspect of spying, but instead at the American people, then B will happen. B being we'll essentially live under a dictatorship. There will be total tyranny where the American people will be unable to fight back because this net of surveillance will cover what we do. And what's really remarkable is that conditional that he warned against, the apparatus of the NSA being directed domestically and inwardly rather than outwardly, has absolutely come to pass. That is the current situation. That is the current circumstance of the United States. The NSA, beginning in 2001 under George Bush, was secretly ordered to spy domestically on the communications of American citizens. It has escalated in all sorts of lawless and now lawful ways, such that it is now a normal part of what that agency does. Even more significantly, the technology that it has developed is now shared by a whole variety of agencies, including the FBI, so that this surveillance net that Frank Church warned so stridently about, in a way that if you stood up now, you'd be immediately branded a sort of shrill, self-marginalized radical, has come to be in all sorts of entrenched and legal ways. Now, there's a few ways to think about the surveillance state and to try and understand its scope and magnitude. And I think the most effective way to do that is just to look at a couple of numbers and to use the most mainstream sources to do that, in terms of where we are in terms of the American surveillance state. So in 2010, the Washington Post published a three-part series called Top Secret America, written by their Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Dana Priest and William Arkin. And the first installment in that series looked at the national security state and the surveillance state and how it functions in the United States. And this was one of the sentences that appeared in this article. Listen to this. It said, quote, Every day, collection systems at the National Security Agency intercept and store 1.7 billion emails, phone calls, and other types of communication. That's every day they intercept and store, they keep for as long as they want, 1.7 billion emails and other forms of telephonic communications. William Binney is a NSA official who was a fairly high-ranking NSA official for several decades, and he resigned in the wake of 9/11 because he was so outraged that the NSA was starting to be turned against the American people, and he resigned, and recently he's begun to speak out about the NSA's abuses. And he gave an interview on Democracy Now 3 weeks ago, and this is what he said about surveillance under the Obama administration. He said, quote, "Surveillance has increased every year since 9/11. In fact, I would suggest that they've assembled on the order of 20 trillion transactions about U.S. citizens with other U.S. citizens. 20 trillion transactions have been assembled by the NSA and its related agencies about U.S. citizens interacting with other U.S. citizens." He then went on to add that that's only emails and telephone calls and not things like financial transactions or other forms of video surveillance. So that pretty much tracks what the Washington Post reported as well. If you're storing 1.7 billion emails and telephone calls each and every day, it's likely that you'll fairly quickly reach the 20 trillion level that William Binney identified. Now, the most amazing thing about the surveillance state, given how incredibly ubiquitous it is and how incredibly menacing it is that we actually know very little about it. We're almost back to the mid-1970s when nobody even knew what the NSA was. The big joke in Washington whenever anyone would mention the NSA was that NSA stood for no such agency. It was just something that you were not permitted to talk about, even in government. No one knew what it did. We're basically at that point. We get little snippets of information, like the two statistics that I just described, that give us a sense of just how sprawling and all-encompassing the surveillance state is, but we don't very much know about who runs it, how it's operated, at whom it's directed, and who makes those decisions. And in fact, so clear is that lack of knowledge that there's an amazing controversy right now about the Patriot Act. You may remember in the aftermath of 9/11, the Patriot Act used to be something that was really controversial. In the September, October of 2001, Congress enacted this law, and everyone ran around warning that it was this massive expansion of surveillance that was unlike anything we had ever seen before. It became the symbol of Bush-Cheney radicalism. Now the Patriot Act is completely uncontroversial. It gets renewed without any notice every 3 years with zero reforms, no matter which party is in control. And there are two Democratic senators who are very kind of mainstream, loyal Democratic Party supporters. They're President Obama supporters. They're like Frank Church, but even a little bit more mainstream within the Democratic Party. One is Ron Wyden of Oregon, and the other is Mark Udall of Colorado. And what these two Democratic Party senators have been doing for the last 3 years is running around warning that the Patriot Act is so much worse than anything that any of us thought all that time when we were objecting to it. And the reason it's so much worse is because the U.S. government has secretly interpreted it, what the Patriot Act permits it to do in terms of surveillance on American citizens, that's completely unrelated to what the law actually says, and is something that almost nobody knows. Just listen to these two quotes that they gave to the New York Times a month ago. Senator Wyden said, quote, "I want to deliver a warning this afternoon. When the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they will be stunned and they will be angry." Now, he's talking about a different American people than the one that I know, but the point that he's making is that if you were paying attention and cared about these things the way you should, you would be stunned and angry to learn about what the government is doing, even under this already broad act. Senator Udall said, quote, "Americans would be alarmed if they knew how this law is being carried out." Now, they are two, as I said, establishment Democrats warning that the Democratic-controlled executive branch is massively abusing this already incredibly broad Patriot Act. And one of the things that they're trying to do is to extract some basic information from the NSA about what it is that they're doing in terms of the surveillance aimed at American people, because even though they're on the Intelligence Committee, the committee that the Church Committee created to oversee the intelligence community, they say they don't even know the most basic information about what the NSA does, including even how many Americans have had their emails read or telephone calls intercepted by the NSA. And so one of the things they did a couple months ago was they wrote a demand to the NSA saying, we don't want you to tell us anything sensitive. We just need to know the basic information about what it is that you're doing, such as, for example, the thing we really want to know is how many American citizens on U.S. soil have had their emails read by you and their telephone calls listened to you by you. That's what we want to know most of all. And the NSA responded 2 weeks ago by saying, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm not saying this to be humorous, I'm not being ironic, I'm not snippeting out a part of it to distort it. Their answer was, look, we can't tell you how many millions of Americans are having their emails read by us and their telephone calls listened in by us, because for us to tell you that would violate the privacy of American citizens. And I mean, I just so you believe me, because if I were you, I would be thinking, oh, that's ridiculous. I don't know whatever he's saying can't be true. I just want to read you from the letter that the head of the NSA wrote to the Senate Intelligence Committee in response. They said, quote, the NSA Inspector General and NSA leadership both agree that a review of the sort you're suggesting would itself violate the privacy of U.S. persons. So, you know, I think the important thing to realize is how little we know about what it is that they're doing, but the little that we do know is extraordinarily alarming in exactly the way that Frank Church described. Now, I just want to make a couple of other points about the surveillance state that don't get enough attention, but that really are necessary for completing the picture about what it really is and what it does. We talk a lot about things like the NSA and federal government agencies like the FBI, but it actually expands well beyond that. We really live in a culture of surveillance. I mean, if you even go into any normal American city or even increasingly small and mid-sized towns, there are all kinds of instruments of surveillance everywhere that you probably don't even notice. If you wake up in the morning and drive to your local convenience store, you've undoubtedly been photographed by all sorts of surveillance cameras on the street. If you go to the ATM to take out money to buy things, that will be then recorded. If you go into a convenience store to buy the things you want to buy, you'll have your photograph taken and will be recorded. And it's not just the government that is engaged in surveillance, but just as menacingly, corporations, private corporations, engage in huge amount of surveillance on us. They give us cell phones that track every moment where we are physically and then provide that to law enforcement agencies without so much as a search warrant. Obviously, credit card and banking transactions are recorded and tell anyone who wants to know everything that we do. When we talk about the scandal of the Bush eavesdropping program, that was not really a government eavesdropping program so much as it was a private industry eavesdropping program. It was done with the direct and full cooperation of AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, and the other telecom giants. In fact, when you talk about the American surveillance state, what you're really talking about is no longer public government agencies. What you're talking about is a full-scale merger between the federal government and industry. That is what the surveillance state is. They are equally important parts of what the surveillance state does. I think the most interesting and probably revealing example that I can give you about where we are in terms of surveillance in the United States was a really ironic and unintendedly amusing series of events that took place in mid-2011. What happened in mid-2011 was that the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which, as we know, are very, very oppressive and hate freedom, they said that what they were going to do was ban the use of BlackBerries and similar devices on their soil. And the reason is that the corporation that produces BlackBerries was either unable or unwilling to guarantee that Saudi and UAE intelligence agencies would be able to intercept all communications. And the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates were horrified by the prospect that people might be able to communicate on their soil without them being able to intercept and surveil that communication. And in response, they banned BlackBerries. And this created huge amounts of condemnation in the Western world. Every American newspaper editorialized about how this showed how much these governments were the enemies of freedom. The Obama administration issued a stinging denunciation of both governments, saying that they were engaged in the kinds of oppression that we couldn't tolerate. And yet 6 weeks later, the New York Times reported that the Obama administration was preparing legislation to mandate that all services that enable communications, I'm quoting from the New York Times, to mandate that all services that enable communications, including encrypted email transmitters like BlackBerry, social networking websites like Facebook, and software that allows direct peer-to-peer messaging like Skype, be designed to ensure government surveillance. It was exactly the same principle that everybody condemned the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for. The principle being that there can be no human interaction, especially no human communication, not just from foreign nationals and between foreign nationals, but by American citizens on American soil that is beyond the reach of the US government. This was the mindset that in 2002 led the Bush administration to dredge up John Poindexter from wherever it was that he was, and he was actually in, working for defense contractors, and they dredged him up, and he was gonna start the program that they called the Total Information Awareness Program. And the logo, which I actually looked at in the last couple of weeks that you should go and look at, just because you won't believe how creepy it is, has a pyramid with this huge eye hovering over it. This eye that was gonna be the all-seeing eye. And the only problem with the Total Information Awareness Program was that they just put a name on it that was too honest about what it was. And it freaked everybody out. And so they had to pretend that they weren't gonna go forward with it. But of course, what they did was they've incrementally and in very clear ways recreated the Total Information Awareness Program under a whole variety of different legislative initiatives. And this idea that every single form of technological communication by law must be constructed to permit government backdoor interception and surveillance is an expression of what this surveillance state mindset is, that there can be no such thing as any form of privacy from the US government. That is the mindset that has led the surveillance state to be this sprawling, vast, ubiquitous, and always expanding instrument that state and corporate power users employ in order to safeguard their power. The one other point that's worth making about how this works, about how the surveillance state works and how power is exercised through it, and this I think is probably the most pernicious part, and I refer to this as the one-way mirror, the government's one-way mirror. At exactly the same time, this is really so remarkable to me, at exactly the same time that the government has been massively expanding its ability to know everything that we're doing, it has simultaneously erected a wall of secrecy around it that prevents us from knowing anything that they're doing. There was this amazing controversy when the documents from WikiLeaks were disclosed and the American media had to rush to assure everybody simultaneously that this was both a completely meaningless act and a completely horrible act. So the two claims that were made was this horrible, traitorous organization, WikiLeaks, has severely damaged American national security, but at the same time, we want you to know there's nothing new in anything that they've disclosed. There's nothing worth knowing. That was literally the two claims that were made, and nobody ever bothered to reconcile those. But what was true is that of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages that WikiLeaks disclosed, it's actually in excess of a million now. There were the vast, vast bulk of it were very banal content. It was stuff that really wasn't particularly interesting, that didn't reveal very much about anything that was worth knowing. And what was actually so scandalous about that was that very fact, because every single page that WikiLeaks disclosed was stamped classified and it made a crime to disclose any of it, even though so much of it was banal and revealed nothing worth knowing. And what that reflected is that the US government reflexively labels everything that it does of any conceivable significance as classified and secret. It keeps everything that it does from us at the very same time that it knows more and more about what we're doing. And if you think about how warped that is, what a radical reversal of how things are supposed to work, it's really startling. The idea is supposed to be, and this is just basic political science, basic design of the founding, that there's supposed to be transparency for government. We're supposed to know virtually everything that they do. Individuals are supposed to live in a sphere of privacy. Nobody's supposed to know what we're doing unless there's a demonstrated good reason to invade that wall of privacy. We've completely reversed that so that the government now operates with complete secrecy and we have none. And the reason this is so disturbing is you can just look at the famous aphorism typically attributed to Francis Bacon that knowledge is power. If I'm able to know everything about you, what you do, what you think, what you fear, where you go, what your aspirations are, the bad things that you do, the bad things you think about, and you know nothing about me, I have immense leverage over you in all kinds of ways. I can think about how to control you. I can blackmail you. I can figure out what your weaknesses are. I can manipulate you in all sorts of ways. That is the state of affairs that this surveillance state, combined with the wall of secrecy, has brought about.
That was Glenn Greenwald, who spoke in Chicago on June 28, 2012. The full audio of this presentation is online at Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Order in the court. Yo, I can't believe they got the PE in court before the judge on some nonsense. I got the S1s ready. Chuck Flame, what's up?
Court, now in court, cause I stole a beat. This is a sampling for it, but I'm giving it a new name. What you hear is my PE. You know the time. Now what in the heaven does a jury know about hell if I took it? But they just look at me like, hey, I'm on a mission. Check it out, y'all. Conditions ain't right. Sitting like dynamite. Going to blow you up and it just might blow up the bench in. Judge the courtroom, plus I gotta mention, this court is dismissed when I grab the mic, yo, Flay.
What is this? What y'all think y'all doing bringing us to court for this guy and saying we stealing beats? Y'all can't copyright no beats, man. Yo, judges, they crazy, man.
Get hyped. Come on, we gotcha. Gather around, gotcha. Mail from the courts in jail. Claims I stole the beats in our realm. Look at how I'm living like. If they're gonna check the mic, right, side. Come on, cause I'm living low. Lower than low.
When it comes to the early roots of hip-hop music, there might be no sharper contrast between that and the present-day wide-scale depiction of hip-hop. In its early days, hip-hop was a key form of expression for disadvantaged youth in areas of poverty. In the present day, hip-hop music ranks among the most popular genres of music, with the most prominent names earning millions of dollars. How did this transformation happen? And how is the music affected as a result? We'll learn more about the corporatization of hip-hop in this interview with Chicago professor Lance Williams. Lance Williams spoke with Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stupinchik on Friday, June 7th, 2013.
We are joined on the phone with Lance Williams. Lance Williams is associate professor and assistant director at the Jacob H. Carruthers Center for Inner City Studies at Northeastern Illinois University, and he is joining us on the phone. Lance Williams, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
The topic is the corporatization of hip-hop. Just to make sure that we're clear on our terms, what exactly is meant by the corporatization of hip-hop?
Well, I think when you talk about the corporatization of hip hop, you're talking about the interfacing between hip hop as an expression, an indigenous expression that originated in places like South Bronx in New York, an expression, a youth expression that started to emerge in the late 70s. In the late 60s, early 70s, and kind of existed underground as a youth kind of music, but began to interface with corporate music companies by the late 70s. And so when we say the corporatization, we're talking about the expression of the original elements of hip hop that began to transform and change as they interact more and more with corporate entities.
Elaborate, if you would, please, a little bit on some of those original elements. What was hip-hop like before a kind of corporatization, and what would define hip-hop?
Well, I think if you look at the early expressions or elements, so to speak, of hip-hop, you're looking at four original, what we would call original elements. You're looking at the what we would call the art of the MC, the art of the DJ, the art of tagging or graffiti, and then the art of breakdancing. So to put that in chronological order, the art of the DJ was the first element of hip hop, which consisted of a DJ playing music out in a park for kids using the turntables. But then ultimately what happens is the MC is joined, I'm sorry, the DJ is began to be joined by MCs who would kind of, you know, hype the crowd and get the crowd ready for the DJ. So those two elements emerge kind of, you know, early on in the expression of the music, and then later you get the youth who dance to the break that the DJ plays. They are identified as the break dancers and become synonymous with this new youth music called hip hop. And then later you get youth who in the Bronx who were involved in graffiti and tagging to kind of join that movement, and they round out the elements. But also there are some aesthetics that go along with those elements, like the principle of keeping it real. So that principle of keeping it real emerged in the music because these were marginalized kids who were kind of critiquing society, saying that society is based on a lie, you know, that in society you have to, you know, wear your clothes a certain kind of way in order to progress. You have to think a certain kind of way. You have to act a certain kind of way in order to benefit from being a member of society. But they viewed in their communities where there was unfairness, inequality, and so their way of critiquing it was to speak the truth, right, and tell it like it is, so to speak. And so that became very central to this new music, that you have to speak the truth of your existence, regardless of how ugly it is. And it was criticism of other entertainers like the singers and R&B singers who they said only sung songs of love. And for instance, I remember a lyric by a Public Enemy where they said, you silly singers are spineless as you sing your senseless songs to the mindless. So this is a famous hip hop lyric that criticized the singers. So keeping it real was important in the lyrics of hip hop. So keeping it real, the male bravado was also a central part of it. The party aesthetic, being true to yourself and where you come from. So those were the original elements and aesthetics of hip hop. When corporate entities began to take part of it, then they kind of tweak those images and change it more into a fun expression. So when you look at early groups, like commercial groups like the Sugar Hill Gang, their voice was absent of the political tone that you found in early hip hop. And also then you get the gangster element that emerged as well. So when corporations began to engage the music, they saw these communities that hip hop came from as gangster infested, crime infested, drug infested. And so they looked for music to promote that reflected their perspective of the community. And true hip hop artists criticized that, saying that although those things existed in predominantly marginalized black communities, it was just one aspect. So what we saw was, after corporations became involved in hip hop, we saw more and more of the pathology reflected in the music as opposed to a holistic kind of expression.
In the history of technology, at least I've done some work on this and kind of researched it, there have been efforts regarding struggle to try to preserve maybe the original impulses against a kind of top-down corporatization. Was there a kind of struggle to block or to try to slow down or offset the corporatization of hip-hop, to your knowledge?
That struggle continues, as a matter of fact. So, yeah, from the beginning, there was a struggle to resist that. But it was difficult because then when the record companies came in, they came in with so much money. And then they came in with the ability to give artist status in their communities, and, you know, not only locally but nationally and globally. So you always had the fight between the artists who wanted to keep it real and keep true to the art form, who wanted to express hip-hop in its in their original forms. But then, you know, you also have young people who are living in poor communities who get a record deal, right? And when they get the record deal, money comes along with that, and they go for it. And so, but yeah, that struggle has always been there, and it continues.
That actually leads to one question I could hear. Someone who might propose a kind of devil's advocate position might say that this isn't a bad thing, this kind of corporatization of hip-hop, for precisely for this very reason. You can make art and make money at the same time, and that kind of engenders some form of success. And if you have to, you know, compromise a little bit about what you're saying, that might not be seen as a bad thing by some. Similarly, some might say that, okay, it's not like that those who might pose a kind of hip-hop of a critical nature or with a critical message have disappeared. You still have folks who are saying those kinds of oppositional things and who have a voice. How do you respond when people kind of pose these kinds of arguments in response back saying that that this corporatization isn't a bad thing?
Yeah, well, I think, I've heard that point and that kind of perspective for quite a while. And I think generally you could say that there is some validity to that to a certain degree. So when I say to a certain degree, clearly there are a number of artists, you know, quite few in numbers, who are able to capitalize and benefit from being a part of the music industry as hip-hop or hip-hop artists or rap artists, so to speak. But when you look overall, you see a very exploitive kind of experience for people, particularly young people who go into the music industry. Most of them, you know, when they get a deal, when they get a record deal, they're surprised to learn when they sign a contract, especially if they're not represented, you know, well, that they get, you know, less than 9% of the profit, right? And so you really, really, in this day and time, you have to sell, you know, millions of records in order to make a decent profit. And, you know, you just don't make that, you know, record. The music industry has collapsed since the emergence of, you know, of being able to download music online. So, you know, artists, even the best artists, don't sell a lot of records. And what ends up happening is they sign these deals where, you know, maybe, you know, they have a 2 to 3 album deal with a record company, and they end up owing the record company at the end of the deal because they just, the amount of money that was given to them in an advance, which is actually a loan, they never recoup. So, you know, 90% of young people that go into the industry come out even more broke on the back end than they were when they went into the industry.
Some might argue in response back, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, that this has always been the kind of circumstance, or rather, I guess, let me ask, has this always been the case, or is this a rather new phenomenon, or relatively new?
No, this has always been the case in the music industry, particularly as music becomes more corporate entities become involved in music. So, yes, it's in entertainment and music has always been problematic in this sense. It's not something that's unique to hip-hop at all.
I could hear also kind of taking a both a critical stance, but also a kind of oppositional stance at the same time. Some people may respond back to say that the kind of corporatization of hip hop may serve as a kind of attempt to squelch voices, to suppress free speech, and perhaps even suppress efforts by communities where hip hop predominates, African-American mostly in the United States, in an effort to try to squelch those communities. Do you think that this kind of represents an effort to try to squelch those kinds of efforts, or is it just kind of something that comes along for the ride? How does this figure in all this?
Yeah, well, I could tell you this. You know, as hip-hop matured, so I talk about the history of hip-hop, you know, beginning in the late 60s, early 70s, and then it kind of exists as an underground form of music through the end of the 70s. In 78, 79, we get the Sugar Hill Gang. But then what happens is, and that's kind of commercial, kind of popish, you know, rap music, so to speak. But then what happens in the mid-80s to the late 90s, you get this heavy social political rap in groups like Public Enemy and Poor Righteous Teachers and Brand Nubian and Queen Latifah and KRS-One. So it becomes very political. But interestingly, right at that moment, kind of halfway through that moment, maybe in the late 80s, then you get the emergence of gangster rap. So if you look at the golden era of hip hop that I just discussed from the mid 80s to the late 90s as a kind of social political voice in hip hop, then interestingly, the gangster rap form of rap music with the N.W.A.s and the Ice-T's, then they come about in the at the point that the golden era is reaching its peak. So it looks like the industry decided that this golden era or the social political rap was not, you know, in their interest anymore, and they wanted more of a kind of a gangster rap kind of element. So I'm saying that to say that it kind of speaks to what you just mentioned, where the companies decided that they didn't want the social political voice. Now, do I think that there was a conspiracy of music companies to sit down? I don't think so. I think what happened was they knew that the music primarily was purchased by suburban young, you know, whites, who were uncomfortable maybe with this heavy pro-black, anti-white kind of message that you heard during the golden era of hip hop. And they decided to distribute and produce music that those youth were more comfortable with. The youth wanted to hear the narrative of the hood. And so they gave them what they wanted. And, It made larger society, I believe, mainstream society, more comfortable. I think that music of the golden era of hip-hop was very critical of American society, and it made folks who purchased the music and the folks who owned the stations and distributed the music more uncomfortable. So they just decided to go with music that wasn't as uncomfortable.
We've been talking a little bit, and you've been making reference to the geography mostly of New York, but I'm just wondering, being from Chicago, were there efforts in Chicago with regards to both the, I guess, establishment of hip-hop and the corporatization of hip-hop, as well as resistance against the corporatization of hip-hop? Are there Chicago connections here?
Well, you know, the Chicago connection of hip-hop kind of, you know, comes in. I think if you look at the early artists that become commercial in Chicago, you're beginning to talk about groups that, you know, they emerge in the late 80s, early 90s during the golden era of hip hop. So they were part of, you know, the hip hop scene, but kind of looked a lot like New York to a certain degree. And then you didn't get the gangster element with the Twisters. You know, Twister ends up becoming probably the first most popular gangster kind of rapper, even though he was kind of a not all gangster. You know, he had the tongue twister style, and then you get Crucial Conflict off the West Side. But then at the same time, you have Common, who at the time was Common Sense, emerging around that time as well, but he's more on the golden era of hip hop side. He was considered and is still considered a conscious hip hop artist. The industry itself, you know, you didn't find many of the major industries, music industries here in Chicago. Those artists were signed by, you know, companies out of New York.
How are things faring now with regards to both the state of hip hop as well as the resistance and the corporatization of hip hop? We've been talking about, and kind of, it seems like that the history kind of extends a little bit into the present day, maybe within the last 5 years or so. But what have things been like in the last 5 years?
Well, you know, it's been interesting. In Chicago, we have a very interesting dynamic. You know, I don't know why this is the case, and it may have something to do with the fact that Chicago is kind of between the East Coast phenomenon and the West Coast phenomenon. And of course, the East Coast phenomenon kind of has more of the traditionalist expression of hip hop, although, you know, they you know, it's a diverse expression all over America. And the West Coast kind of has the gangster element of hip hop, and then the South kind of has the dirty South gangster kind of expression, meaning the most popular forms. So I guess in Chicago, we have a mixture of all of those expressions. We're kind of in the middle of all of it. And it's funny because if you look at the most popular rappers now, they reflect that diversity. So we have, you know, artists, I mean, and these are artists that are prominent, you know, globally. So if you look at a artist like a Lupe Fiasco, who definitely represents the more conscious side of hip hop. But on the flip side of that, you have Chief Keef, who represents the gangster, the most gangster element aspect of hip hop. So, I think the gangster Dirty South element kind of rules the day in hip hop today, nationally and globally. And the more conscious forms of hip hop, you really don't find in commercial rap. I mean, Lupe, you don't hear much of that much of Common these days, but Lupe would be maybe the only artist that I can think of right now that you can hear commercially that represents that conscious voice. Pretty much the rest of the artists represent the kind of the gangster pathology form of rap music.
That poses a kind of interesting thing, that someone like a Lupe Fiasco, or perhaps anyone with a conscious message, but also popular, and perhaps decidedly so, would fall into some kind of a tension where their popularity is because of their critical message, but yet their critical message is antithetical to the powers that be that want the money but don't want the message, even though the money kind of comes with the message. And so a tension would, at least I can imagine, a tension emerging as that. Do you feel like that's what's going on here, or are there perhaps other factors that might be coming into play?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, it's hard to it's hard for corporations to stifle extreme creativity. You know, I think that's what makes you Lupe unique, because on one hand he's very socially, politically conscious in his music, which makes, I think, you know, mainstream institutions very uncomfortable. But at the same time, he expresses such creativity, he attracts, you know, mainstream society. You know, and he's unique in that sense. So they will tolerate it because of his creativity. And you have so many people who, you know, who will listen to commercial music that is more political, and they're interested in that. But it has to be a unique artist that you can't just be like back in the day when you had like a Public Enemy who was just straight political, right? And didn't necessarily finesse the creative side of hip hop and wasn't interested in that. It just came a hardcore political message. Well, those kind of acts and those kind of groups cannot survive in this type of market. But a Lupe Fiasco can, because he's got the creative artistic side of the expression, the beautiful music, the melodic music that goes along with a political message. And I think that's why, you know, he has success.
And that sounds like that's a rare breed.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
The it would seem to me like the corporatization of hip hop, as well as struggles against that corporatization and trying to preserve a kind of authentic, grassroots, responsible sense, it seems like is emblematic of other aspects where you see the struggle played out in the media, in art, in life, and elsewhere, where there's attempts to try to suppress it and control it, and the resistance kind of plays out. Do you feel like this is emblematic of how this occurs elsewhere, or is this different in some fashion? Well, I can mention right now regarding protests regarding, let's say, Occupy Wall Street, for example. There are efforts there to try to organize that, and there's clearly a suppression where the main success of that has been driven out and not quite destroyed, but kind of driven into a kind of not as big in a public prominent profile. Same thing here, where you may have artists who have integrity, but who are not very successful precisely because they didn't either get lucky or because they're not having the kind of the lucky breaks that, you know, someone like maybe someone who could speak a critical voice but not get mainstream audience that where they could become a worldwide phenomenon. Do you think that that's kind of an emblem here?
So are you comparing? I'm not getting your question. I'm wondering. So are you comparing the social movement and the kind of attempt to stifle social movements to the social political voice in hip hop?
Yes.
You're comparing the two?
Or trying to? Yeah, well, are there points for comparison?
Question. So okay, I get that. Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that in the reason that it makes sense is because I think the same corporate, you know, model and the whole capitalistic critique that comes from groups like Occupy and the 99% movement, it's the same. You know, they're critiquing the same entity. You know, in the music, it's the same group. Like, if you look at the multinational media conglomerates that basically control everything in the media, you know, from television to radio to internet. You know, they have the whole thing on lock. Well, that's the same force and the same institutions that Occupy would be critiquing. You know, so if you look at power institutions in America, you're looking at the economic institutions, the banks. You're looking at the political institutions. You're looking at the military. You're looking at the media. So you know it's the same institutions that Occupy would criticize and protest is the same entity that the music industry is a part of. You know, and so it would make sense that if there's going to be oppression and stifling of these social movements, you're going to have the same stifling of the voice, that voice in entertainment or in the media industries.
For folks who are interested in learning more, what sources would you recommend? And perhaps even more critically, what musicians or performers or groups might you recommend regarding a kind of more authentic voice of hip hop?
I have a particular personal preferences, and I would hate to, you know, say that, you know, what I like is what, you know, folks should. I think people listen to what, you know, what they're comfortable with, because some people would say, well, you know, how could you say, you know, artists like Lil Wayne don't represent hip hop? I think they do. They just represent a counter kind of liberation voice in hip hop, you know, versus a Mos Def or a Talib Kweli or, you know, a Lupe, Common, and those kind of guys who, to me, are counter hegemonic voices. You know, they're voices of fighting oppression and inclusion versus other voices that, you know, I think exacerbate the problems that we have in our communities. So, you know, I wouldn't want to point people in any particular direction. I would just say, you know, don't restrict your listening to the commercial music, you know, kind of expand and try to, you know, search around, you know, via the internet to find, you know, alternative voices.
We've been speaking with Lance Williams. He is the associate professor and assistant director at the Jacob H. Carruthers Center for Inner City Studies at Northeastern Illinois University, an authority on the corporatization of hip hop, for which he has been graciously providing insight. Lance Williams, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Radio for All and Alternative Radio for audio assistance. Thank you for listening, and be sure to join us again for another episode from the Trenches.